Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Brady Corbet, the director of The Childhood of a Leader, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. This is the week that was. The Republican National Convention is going on in Cleveland, and here we are in New York, where we just are biding our time. This is going to be a very interesting summer and fall. Really will be. I cannot imagine how crazy things are going to get in this election, but we'll just forge ahead. We'll keep talking about film and the world of cinema and just ride it out. Ride it out. That's all you can do. This episode's a little bit jam-packed. I'm already a little behind schedule here because I spoke to the lovely filmmaker, I can call him that now, Brady Corbet. Brady was on a while ago. I'm going to find you that episode number so you can go back and listen to that. Actually, if you're a fan of the show, you come around to it maybe more recently, maybe you didn't have a chance to listen to such an old episode. Number 139, Brady Corbet was on. With the director of a movie called Simon Killer, in which he starred. So Brady and Antonio Campos were both on that episode. Again, that was episode 139, and we're up to episode 362, for freak's sake. So you know, a lot of time, a lot of water under the bridge. Met with Brady to discuss this film that we're going to talk about. It's called The Childhood of a Leader. It actually opened in theaters today as I record this, so it's already going to be in the past tense when you listen to it, but it's in theaters now. It is sensational. What a debut as a filmmaker. Pretty intense. He's been working on this for many, many, many years, and you're going to hear him talk about it at length. What a great guest Brady Corbet is. I mean, honestly, these are the guests that you love. They come on, they're excited to talk about their project. You ask them a question, and they give you a nice, robust answer. They're engaging you in conversation. They're laughing. They're talking. It's fantastic. It's a podcaster's dream. So thank you, Brady, for coming back on the show for a second visit. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Then, Catfish. Remember that, you know the show. Catfish. I mean, it was a documentary. And then it became a series. It's a TV series. It's reality TV, but it's not like The Housewives of Kenosha. But I do wonder how they find so many catfished people. I asked them about it. Not only that, but I actually pranked Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, the creators, the producers of Catfish, the series, and a brand new movie, an exciting, fun movie called Nerve, which is coming out in theaters in just a matter of days, and it stars Emma Roberts and David Franco. Anyway, Henry Joost, Ariel Schulman, pranked right here on Filmwax Radio. And finally, Leslie McCleave, a lovely person and filmmaker who I met last year when I was a juror at the Nashville Film Festival, where I got to see How Sweet the Sound, The Blind Boys of Alabama, her documentary about that, you know, group of singers. Got to meet some of them in Nashville. It was terrific. The film is going to be playing at the Stony Brook Film Festival coming up in just a matter of days. And so, I'm going to play you this segment with Leslie McCleave. That's the show. Very excited to play it for you. Lots of conversation. We'll have Brady Corbet first coming up right now. I should say that, let's see, we'll just get right to it, but I want to make sure I let you know what this movie is about, the official description of The Childhood of a Leader here. It's described as the chilling fable about the rise of fascism in the 20th century, and it tells the story of a young American boy living in France in 1918 whose father is working for the U.S. government on the creation of the Treaty of Versailles. What he witnesses helps to mold his beliefs, and we witness the birth of a terrifying ego. This is a really great film. It stars Robert Pattinson, Liam Cunningham, and a number of other actors, including this young boy who is just unbelievably good, named Tom Sweet. The film is opening in theaters all around the country, as it deserves to, I might add. This is really an exceptionally good film. I loved it. I'm going to go see it in the theater, in fact, maybe this weekend. But let's go to the trailer right now.
Is everything all right upstairs?
He's been acting out of it.
Why would you do that?
He's only a little boy. He didn't actually hurt anyone, did he?
We had quite a week here. He's been upset with me lately.
No! Oh, Zayda giving you a French lesson today.
Hello there, chap.
Are you spying on us?
No.
He's just a little boy. You cannot allow a child to run this household. I am your father, and you will show some respect. I will count to three. One, two, three.
Okay, anyway, you know Brady Corbet, of course, from his many, many films that he's acted in. Going back to, I think, his real debut was in 13, back in 2003. He's since been in Mysterious Skin, Funny Games, the Michael Haneke remake. He remade his own film. He had the German version of Funny Games, and then he remade it in English language with an all... English-speaking cast, including Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, and, you know, of course, Brady was in it, and it's a terrifying performance. I only recommend it if you can put up with pretty terrifying stuff. He, of course, was again in Marcy May Marlene, where he was his, I think, unless I'm mistaken, his introduction to the guys over at Borderline Films. He would later collaborate again with those guys, with Simon Keller. But in between Marcy May Marlene and Simon Keller, he was in Lars von Trier's Melancholia, which I think is my favorite of all the Lars von Trier. I know it's over the top, but it's still a shocking, wonderful film. And since then, he's been in many other films, including, Saint Laurent, Force Majeure, one of my favorite films from 2014, Clouds of Sils Maria, and on and on. This is a very talented person. It's his first feature-directed film, A Conversation with Brady Corbet. Do you remember?
I don't remember that, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure you do so much press.
When was it? For which film?
It was for Simon Keller.
Uh-huh.
And it was with you and Antonio.
Thank you. It was in New York?
Yeah, it was at the Crosby Street Hotel.
Uh-huh.
We were sitting in the restaurant, the cafe.
Yeah, I remember.
It's like, you know, if
yeah,
you had
yeah,
the place.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
We had a really nice conversation. Yeah. I was a fan of the film, and then we went out into the back... courtyard for a few seconds to take a couple of pictures on the, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that.
Do
I remember
you?
That press day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So I was perusing on this internet thing, and Brady, and is it every single interview you have to correct people, first of all, of course, on the pronunciation of your name, Corbet, because everybody wants to say Corbett and all that. That's so you're just so used to that.
Yeah, sure.
You know, maybe there'll be a day where it just tips, and you'll be such a profoundly famous director, actor, that
that it becomes a part of the modern vernacular.
Yeah, exactly. It's Corbet. But it's so funny, because I was watching a few things, and there's always the correction of the... Yeah, and it's you said that this was actually, when I say this, I'm referring to your movie, that this is your directorial debut of a feature film, at least.
Yeah,
you may have
right.
made some shorts, I'm not sure, but it's called The Childhood of a Leader,
uh-huh.
And you came up with this is it concept over 10 years ago, is that true?
Yeah, that is true. I read a book called Paris 1919, which was an account of the 6 months leading up to the signing of the Treaty of Versailles by Margaret Macmillan, mm-hmm. who is a relative of Churchill's and is a great historian. And she also like gives amazing lectures. There's like amazing podcasts and stuff from
really?
Margaret Macmillan.
Oh, well, look
She's
it
got
up.
An amazing voice. But anyway, I was really haunted by this book, and I think that it was one of the few historical accounts that I'd ever read cover to cover, mm-hmm. you know, because I'd read, I'm somewhat of a history buff, but, you know, I think I've read, like, the first 300 pages of Napoleon's biography or something.
Really?
I've never completed it. Uh-huh. So, and there's so fucking many of them. So basically, the book at the time... It seemed particularly relevant because we were still at war in Iraq, and it was sort of about the way American foreign policy was forged during this period of time. I mean, it's not the only thing it's about, but it's one of the things it's about. And so I decided that I was going to try and write a screenplay
mm-hmm.
about the peace conference.
You were 16 or something?
Yeah, I was 17.
17?
I was 17.
Jesus.
I didn't want it to be something that was like dry and didactic and
right.
So I started to try and figure out ways of approaching it in a more poetic fashion, I guess. Then I started writing the script, and I got to probably the beginning of the second act or something, and then immediately realized or felt that it was too ambitious mm-hmm. to try and get made anytime soon. I mean, at that
realistically,
point,
yeah.
I thought, okay. I mean,
were you already? I'm sorry to interrupt. I mm-hmm. keep interrupting. Were you already acting at that age?
I was.
When did you start acting? Just so
I started acting when I was seven.
Okay.
When I was
You're
7 years
TV,
old,
right?
I actually,
I'm just guessing.
I didn't do very much TV.
What I said.
But I did. I acted in a film when I was 12 called 13, which was
course.
Like the
yeah.
first
yeah.
movie I ever did.
Catherine Hardwick, who's been on this podcast,
and then before that, I had done like. I had like a line on a television show.
Oh, right.
When I was
well, I
eight
didn't mean
nine.
To, but the answer is seven, right? You
yeah,
said seven.
That's
okay,
right.
so you had already experienced being on the set quite a bit by
sure,
the time you were
sure.
in your teens, and so you
sure.
were like knew what a director did, and you liked that.
Sure.
Or so you were already thinking on a broader than just acting by the time you were hit puberty, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was always interested in filmmaking. I was mm-hmm. always interested in editing as well. And I've been editing since I was about 16 or something. And so I and then I was doing, I actually got a job doing ghostwriting jobs for a friend of mine that had a production company that would owe, you know, like a second or third draft on a, like contractually, but of a film that they never intended to produce, essentially. And so
like a pyramid scheme.
I mean, all of Hollywood's a pyramid scheme. And so he basically knew that he could pay me a lot less money than they would pay someone else to write these scripts. So I started writing a lot of started doing a lot of these ghost jobs, basically. And I guess because I'd read so many screenplays since I was, you know, 10 or 11 or something like that, I knew how to do it. And I understood the formula, essentially. So it's funny because I was writing all these bad scripts for other people, just to make some money, because I was acting, but I was usually acting in like art house movies and not making a lot of money. I mean, if you go and work for Michael Haneke or Lars von Trier or any of these guys, you know, it's amazing to work with them, but you're not getting paid a lot.
Well, say, since we're also getting a beverage that Brady acted in both the second version of Funny Games, which is with Naomi Watts, I think, right?
That's right.
And Michael
Pitt and Tim Roth.
What a cast.
Yeah.
And the four of you, it's just remarkable. And then also in, of course, Melancholia, which was your performance, by the way. I'm not trying to... You know, I don't have to impress you, but that was just blew me away.
You were so
great in that film.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a small role in that film, but
well,
that's very
it's
nice.
Well, small, but it's really shocking. It's a great role. And you do a lot with it. That's really... It's
true. Thanks.
Yeah, and same
thanks
with Simon Killer, which is no... You know, so I'm a fan. So you knew what to do, but this was an incredibly ambitious, and it turns out it's remarkably ambitious for a first feature regardless. The results of The Childhood of a Leader, it's just really...
So basically what happened, I mean, like the point when I actually finished it actually first I should talk about when I put it down. I put it down not only because I was, you know, that age and thought it was too ambitious, but I also put it down because I had applied to the Cannes residence with the project and I didn't even make it to the, you know, the finalists or whatever. So I thought after that initial rejection that I was like, I was sort of disheartened and whatever. So then when I was 23, I was writing a film with my now wife, Mona Fastvold. It was her first film that she was directing, and she'd asked me to write this script for her and with her, based on an idea she had and a place that she wanted to shoot in, which was this like old Mies van der Rohe copy up in upstate New York. And when we were finished writing her film, she convinced me that I should pick this back up, and she said, "And we're going to finish it together," because she said, "You're always talking about it and referencing it, and I think now it's time that you do something about it."
When was that?
That was probably so. I'm 27 now. I'm going to be 28 in August. So this was five years ago.
Wow. So we
finished it together. At this point, we were not a couple. We were just writing together. And over the course of the next 5 years, our lives would change a lot because we finished the script. I immediately left for Paris to try to find a French producer for the project, which proved to be quite difficult. Basically, my background as an actor, it was enough to get me in the room. Like, it was enough for me to someone be like, "Hey, this guy acts
yeah,
for
you
like
got their attention.
Olivier Assayas or Michael Haneke or whatever," and they'd be like, "Will you at least have, you know, sit down with him?" So everyone would sit down with me, but no one took it seriously, and I felt it, and I was, I was really frustrated. I think I met 60 different producers. And then I met a guy named Antoine de Clermont-Tonnerre, who at that point was the president of Unifrance. And I had met him just to get some advice. But he finally said, well, actually, I'd like to produce the film. So, and he had background producing films like Cinema Paradiso and films for Sakharov. And he had a lot of... had really pedigreed producer.
Yeah.
Mona and I decided to relocate to France to try and get the film off the ground because she was one of the producers of the film.
See.
So we relocated to France. At this point, we had become a couple. And a few months later, she was pregnant. And at that point, I had Tim Roth attached to the film, who I obviously knew from Michael Haneke's film.
Mm-hmm.
But he and I had stayed close. Mm-hmm. So I had one cast member, and then I had, you know, a producer.
So you're saying is you can help get Tim Roth on my podcast.
Yes, I can do. I'll make arrangements.
I'm joking, but not really joking, because I would, you know, again.
He's great.
He's such a, an icon.
And too. Tim was really, it's a long story because we ended up pushing right into the Hateful Eight's dates, and I was not able to move my shoot any more than I already had. He basically ended up not being able to do the movie, and it was my fault because I just couldn't. For a variety of reasons, I couldn't wait to do it for another 5 months.
And he was
going to
play
the father. He's an advisor to Woodrow Wilson.
Okay,
but the one thing is that he was actually a really integral part of the process. Because, you know, a lot of things changed, but Tim never did. He was, like, always there. And same with Robert Pattinson. But Robert Pattinson ended up the dates worked, and he's actually in the movie.
He's the comes in the epilogue.
Right? Yeah, he comes in the epilogue, and he plays two roles in the film. But he's also in the beginning of the movie as another character. If we jump back to Paris, though, like several years ago, when my co-writer and producer Mona was pregnant, and my wife,
very proud,
and we were trying to cast the film. Juliette Binoche ended up signing on to the movie, and then she was attached to the movie for over a year. But the problem was she had very, very specific dates that we needed to adhere to.
Otherwise, no go.
And we couldn't get the money together. I mean, the thing that was really frustrating for me, I remember going out to dinner with Juliette and telling her, like, I'm really sorry, but, like, not only have we not raised enough money, we haven't raised any money. Like, I have not. So with Juliette Binoche,
those are fun conversations.
Juliette Binoche, Tim Roth, Robert Pattinson, Scott Walker doing the score.
Oh right,
all of these things, right?
It's an incredible score.
That's really amazing.
It's just so intense, the whole thing.
But I thought that with this package of amazing people involved, that it was going to be a cinch to raise the money for, because we were only looking for $4 million. And $4 million for a film that has a lot of, you know, scope and ambition. So I really thought it was a lot of bang for someone's buck, basically. But nobody wanted to invest in it. They didn't want to invest in it because I was so young. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to invest in it because the subject matter was not that relevant to them.
At the time.
Now it couldn't be more relevant.
Exactly.
So it was really frustrating because people were also confused about the fact that it's sort of like a virtual history. So it starts off in a very realistic place and it ends up in a very evocative but not but not a literal. It's not a literal retelling or literal historical account.
Let's just say, you know, this is right after World War One, and yeah. Right, and as you mentioned, the Versailles Treaty takes place during the course of the story, and exactly. So this is in the early days before, just right before World War Two.
Yeah, exactly. Basically. In 1919, for anyone who is not immediately familiar when they hear, you know, the Versailles Treaty, but the Versailles Treaty, and by the way, it's completely there's gaps in my education about all sorts of things,
sure.
I think it's just fair to fill people in that basically the Treaty of Versailles, or actually it was a series of treaties, that closed World War One and left Germany with a debt that they would not have been able to repay until 1988.
Really?
And yes,
it was 88.
So the thing was is that on the one hand, it was easy to understand why Clemenceau and David Lloyd George were so bloodthirsty, because they'd lost a lot of citizens. 18 million people died, and they needed someone to blame. And even though it was enormously complex, and Germany was not only to blame, of course, but it basically left the nation impoverished and ripe for nationalism to sort of take over 13 years later, 14 years later. This document but the treaty also redrawing of Europe. Basically, it was the Ottoman Empire fell. Mm-hmm. You know, Hungary lost their coastline. Suddenly, there were new borders, and so it created for a very tumultuous and violent era.
Mm-hmm.
And the effects of the Versailles Treaty are still being felt to this day in Syria and all over the world. So basically, what the film is it's about a young boy who's sort of metaphysically linked to this document. So the closer that the adults around him get to completing and signing this document, the more violent his behavior becomes. So the idea was that we would use this home as a sort of microcosm. And like an Ibsen play or something, to sort of like use these archetypes and look at hierarchies, how they're formed, and various shifts in the power dynamic within a household, and talk about that those shifting of the power dynamics in relation to what was happening, you know, then and is still happening in the political, socio-political sphere.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody has remarked how with this boy, what's the young actor, the child actor?
Oh, yeah, Tom Sweet.
Tom Sweet. Yeah. He just bears such, you know, in my mind anyway, he bears such a remarkable likeness to the kid who played Danny in The Shining.
Oh, that's interesting.
Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
Do you see it when I say that? It reminds me.
He really reminds me of like a Visconti kid. But I think it's just like.
That's true.
It's just like his hair, I guess, you know?
It's like the Garden of the Fizzi Contini type of.
Exactly.
Era,
yeah,
films.
Yeah. This kind of.
Which is also about fascism like, and. It's a good comparison.
Yeah, yeah. I love that De Sica movie. It's really great. And so basically, when I was looking for this boy, you know, he walked in and he actually looked like that. Like he walked in the room and that was his real haircut. And
I
was
dramatic.
Like, I was just like amazed. I was like looking for a child of another era.
Yeah.
And then there he was in a soccer jersey, but there he was, you know.
But you could see it. Yeah, it's really
he's amazing, and he had no interest in acting. I mean, he was not like pursuing. He's not a child actor. I mean, we just found him on a soccer field.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Shocking, amazing.
And but now he's acting in movies, and it's really interesting because, like, you know, I don't know if he's going to act his whole life. But he's so smart that I can tell that this has set him off on a path.
Yeah, well, he has options now.
Well, yeah, like he's a really creative and smart guy, and I just feel like it's going to like open up a lot of amazing things for him, which I'm excited about, because it's always weird when you go in and you disrupt a family's life, because you're like, hey, your kid is really special. We want him to star in, you know, a $5 million movie.
He's like in every scene.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, his parents were like, they were like flabbergasted, excited, but they were like,
shocked,
you know? But they were really creative people. So like his mom's a photographer and works in fashion, and his dad is a graphic designer. And they really were super supportive, and they really understood the film, where I was like so terrified I'd find this amazing kid that had like terrible parents, but it was the opposite. They were not only totally normal, but they were also exceptionally special, brilliant, and warm. Mm-hmm. So basically there were so many things that would have been an awkward conversation with another kind of family. I mean, obviously there's the sequence in the film where this kid sort of rebels by refusing to get dressed for a period of time. And I remember like talking to the casting director, and I was like, you know, people are so fucking weird nowadays about anything to do with kids. And I mean, I have a 2-year-old daughter, but I was like, I would never ask a kid to do something I wouldn't be comfortable with my own kid doing, or that I would have felt uncomfortable doing as a kid, you know. But because there was nudity, and it wasn't at all a sexual context, but because there was nudity, and 9 years old is a strange, it's an age where it's kind of like some kids at 9 years old already have a sexuality, and some kids don't. And so one of the things that I had a conversation with him about, I remember asking him, like, do you have crushes on girls? Yeah. Do you like girls or whatever?
Yeah.
And I realized that I was like, thank God he's still a little boy, because he was like, oh, girls, gross. Yeah,
yeah. And my kid is 12 and he's still, I don't believe him anymore, but.
Yeah, well, at 12, he's probably lying to you, right?
the puberty stuff is coming fast and furious, so I don't know.
But this is all just to say that these, so, you know, because his parents were photographers and they had this, they really understood why it was a part of this story and what it was about. And there was we all had a conversation with Tom together to see if that was going to be okay, and it was no problem. He was like, oh yeah, whatever. It's like changing the locker room or whatever. Right. And so everything about. Also, you know, there's some violence in the story and stuff, and
definitely.
And I always wanted them to, you know that their kid was really in good hands. So they were at the monitor with me for the duration of production. I mean, not because they asked to be, but because I asked them to be. Mm-hmm. I said, I just want you to always know what's going on. Because there's also going to, you know, I remember one day we shut down production because I was like, he's really tired. And they were like, yeah, he's super tired. He needs to go to bed. Mm-hmm. Like, and he, even though our days were only 8 or 9 hours, I mean, they were pretty short days.
Which is illegal, like that's a regulation thing too.
Yeah, well, I mean, the child labor laws on movie sets are a little bit more relaxed in Hungary than they are in, like, France, for example.
Where, and you shot in Hungary.
Yeah, we shot in Hungary.
Some remarkable locations.
In France, you can only actually shoot with a kid for 3 hours a day, which is kind of absurd. I mean, having grown up on sets, when I was a kid, I didn't want to leave. I really was happy to be on set. I was excited to be there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's all the three hours is impossible to get any work done, especially if the kid is like the star of the movie. But yeah, it was the whole thing could have been so much more challenging, but because Tom was so brilliant and in tune as well, like, I mean, he, you know, for a 9-year-old boy, he really understood the material. I mean, like, when we, I sat down with him and I said, this is what this is about, and this is what this scene is about, and I wanted to make sure that he understood everything.
The context.
Context of, like, why he was behaving as he was behaving. And
it's such an interesting thing because, you know, having grown up, like I grew up, you know, in the 80s where child actors were all based on their looks and they were cast. So they would just be memorizing or reading the lines, not really understanding. And it was so obnoxious. So, and this is such the antithesis of that. So,
yeah, I mean, one thing I would actually say that one of the best things about my experience that of being a young actor that I brought with me was that I knew that I wanted to be treated like an equal. Right. When I was a kid,
sure,
I was there doing the same job that everyone else was, and I, you know, I didn't need to be treated like an adult, but I wanted to be treated with respect and fairness, and like I understood what was going on.
Not talked down to.
I think it's a huge mistake to try to trick a performance out of a kid. Which you see a lot. Like, a lot of directors have this method where
Dog died.
Yeah, exactly.
School. Not necessarily that cliche anymore, but yeah.
Yeah, no. You're totally, yeah. Exactly. Like, they're like, they don't know how to relate. It's like, they don't know how to relate to kids, so they kind of do this weird thing where they try to, where they can really patronize them.
But if you go back to the days of, like, Mickey Rooney and...
Mm-hmm. And Dorothy.
What's her face? Come on.
I know, it's terrible. I know, hold on.
Judy Greta. Garland. Judy Garland. Sorry, I should have let you have that.
I said Greta. Yeah, Judy Garland. There we go.
And Greta Gerwig. totally. I mean, they were smart. They understood, but they were also lied to. I mean, you know, and they didn't need to be because you could tell they were smart. He's got a career if he wants it, like you say. I think it's, you got a great performance. I mean, it's a terrific film. It's really intense, and it's... And it needs to be seen in a movie theater. I want to add that too.
Yeah,
it really
does. I mean, it's like it's 35mm. It's a 100-piece orchestra.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
I mean, it really
it has scale.
And the other thing is that the first, it's really funny because we can always tell everyone that worked on the film. Whenever anyone references, like, looks at a review, like, we can always tell if somebody watched it on a link or if they saw it in a theater. Because the first 30 minutes are really in the dark.
That's right. There's an overture, and then
we shot in very low lighting conditions. It's very underexposed, but it's properly exposed. So it's like in a movie theater in the dark. It looks perfect, but it's definitely not a movie that, like, works really well if you've got a lot of glare on your screen or something, because it's just like the image
just
disappears.
I saw it in the worst possible way imaginable. I'll just tell you right up front.
But, don't worry, but you can see it again in the theater.
I want to. I actually would love to. I was going to ask them for a screener, which I still might, but if they have a physical one, because, like I said, I saw it in the worst possible way imaginable.
Yeah, the links they have have crazy watermarks on them and stuff. Like, it's totally... wild.
It's a nightmare. There's every possible thing, the only, you know, it's not, except for those little things that, like, you know, that you were like on TV now where something pops in the center of the screen and it's like, you know, says the next show is
exactly
hey, here I am. Oh god. The Childhood of a Leader is the name of the film. It's Brady Corbet's debut as director, and it's magnificent debut. I mean, honestly, I think you're gonna have a wonderful career too as a filmmaker. I mean, this is just a really strongly...
Thanks a lot.
Strongly, I want to say, produced film, but directed. It's wild and intense. So lighten up a little, I'm going to tell you. That's my advice for you. Otherwise, you're going to do enough.
My next film is a little lighter.
Okay. So you've got something already.
Not a lot. It's not a lot lighter, but it's a little lighter.
Okay. That's all right. It's okay. I just had this actor, David Call, on the show again. And
Of course. David? I love David. I worked with David many years ago.
Okay. He's been on now twice. He came into the studio the other day, and he talks about, I'm like, you're the heavy a lot, because he's got those very, you know, leading man looks, and he's tall and thin. And he goes, every time my mom, oh, are you going to die again in this or kill somebody? You know,
yeah.
So he's sort of dark, the things he gets.
It's funny because David is like, he just, it's so funny when somebody is that good looking and yet their taste is just like so, he couldn't be more art house and obscure.
Right.
Like everything everything he pursues, which is just
get
great.
A TV show where you're the cop and just be done with it. But yeah, okay. So you have another thing. So hopefully you'll come back on again, right?
Absolutely. I'm excited. The next one seems like it's coming together a lot faster. Great.
Yeah, that's good.
Which is really good.
Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Of course.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much.
For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, I take a lot of car rides myself, long car rides on the weekends or to work, and I have become very, very addicted to Audible myself. Two titles, for instance, that I recently downloaded was Roger Corman, a prior guest of the show. What's called Roger Corman, Blood-Sucking Vampires, Flesh-Eating Cockroaches, and Driller Killers by Beverly Gray, and also a former guest, William Friedkin. He has his memoir called The Friedkin Connection, two great titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/filmwaxradio for your free audiobook. Nerve. You know, this is very, very apropos of the time. You know, just as this new game, which is very, very intense, this augmented reality game called Pokemon Go has exploded on the scene, and that's a whole other podcast, this movie Nerve comes out, and it's an incredible timing. High school Emma Roberts plays V, or Venus, who is a high school senior who finds herself immersed in an online game of truth or dare, where her every move starts to become manipulated by an anonymous community of watchers. The film co-stars Dave Franco and the lovely Emily Mead, who I just, you know, coincidentally ran into the other night at a comedy event I went to. Okay, and there she was. I got to get in touch with her. Invite her onto the podcast because she's really good. She was in a play with my ex-wife called Undomesticated. I think that was the name of the play. Anyway, the film also stars, let's see who else. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. It's a big budget film, but I'm telling you, I had a blast watching it. And it's directed by Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, who are the co-directors. And they are the co-directors of the film, and they have, of course, the creators of Catfish, the documentary and the series, as well as directing a number of other films, including Paranormal Activity 3 and 4, which were very highly regarded films, I might add, in the found footage genre. And here we go with my conversation with these two guys. We had a lot of fun.
Welcome to Nerve, a game like Truth or Dare, minus the truth. Watchers pay to watch, players play to win, cash and glory. Are you a watcher or a player? Are you a watcher or a player? Are you a watcher, player, watch, player?
It's cool, right?
This looks very sketchy. Is this legal?
V, life is passing you by. You need to take a few risks every once in a while.
I do take risks.
Okay.
You're playing Nerve.
Do you accept your dare, V?
Stranger for five seconds.
Just kiss that guy.
So, this is a podcast called Film Wax Radio, and it's on. Henry. I'm sorry, Charlotte.
Hey, Charlotte Rell.
Actually, it's funny because I was interested in getting an intern. this summer, and I posted a message on Facebook, and you know, I wanted somebody though experienced, older, middle aged, even somebody who's been around, you know,
to make you feel young.
And so I posted something on Facebook asking for that, and I got a response from this woman, and we went back and forth, and she was saying, you know, she was middle aged and kind of dowdy and mother of two divorced women, and I was really looking forward to having her on the, you know, have her on board, and then finally I made a you know, I set a time to meet her. And this young woman showed up.
Catfished him. Oh, my God.
Thank you. That was just a bit. That didn't happen. That was a bit. I thought you guys would.
Fooled me.
Were you really?
Yeah. Guy's a good storyteller. I was like, really? I was like, wow, what
I
an
just
interesting.
Thought of
a movie I saw once. Yeah.
Actually, she's just the daughter of a friend of mine. Cool. But I was thinking on the, I came up with this this idea on the way over, like on the subway.
Uh-huh.
I said, I should try to catfish, you know, come up with a, anyway.
Are your listeners used to those types of pranks?
Well, they're used to, you know, kind of a clown hosting this. Yeah, probably. That's about it. Good. I don't usually prank too much, but I might, but I've lied a lot. Yeah, so.
I
think that's safe
that
to say.
After everything you say now.
Right, exactly. All right, so we're here with Henry Joost and Arielle Shulman, of course. I also think, actually, I know cousins of yours. Yeah. That, you know Shirley Singer?
Yeah, sure do. That's,
it's your aunt.
That's my aunt, yeah.
Okay, and her daughters.
Yeah.
I know them because I know the Singer family historically.
Wow, cool.
So they introduced me, and then like one day, this is years ago, right as Catfish was coming out, I think, the documentary, they said, oh, we have these cousins there, filmmakers. You might be interested in meeting them. And I said, oh, who's that? And they were like, yes, I've heard of Catfish, because it was already at Sundance, and it was already this huge thing.
Did we talk back then?
No. I think, though, I did contact you.
Oh, through, cool.
And I think we may have chatted briefly.
Gave you 6 years to come up with that.
It was six. It has been 6 years. Yeah, I've been working on it for 6 years. And what a relief. But this is, then I get all serious. But this is now a smooth transition. Oh, yeah, I shouldn't laugh at that. No, I got it.
Just
I get
kidding.
It. Yeah, I know. Nerve. So, well, first, though, because there's such an obvious convergence of theme, if that's the right term, you know, between actually all the films, also Paranormal films, even though I know you guys just directed three and four. But there's obviously a lot of common themes that run throughout. So a Nerve takes it even a kind of a degree farther into a little bit kind of almost science fiction. But barely.
Yeah,
maybe
when we started, it was a little more science fiction, but, you know, almost 2 years later, by the time the movie comes out, it's practically reality.
Yeah. This type of, well, certainly the idea of the Nerve is a game. Let's just put it, no single server. Yeah. That technology is. But what is it that is so interesting, what is it about it, this like social networking and that part of technology that is just such a, you know, a strong theme that you guys keep kind of coming back to it one way or the other? Henry, what's the matter? You don't feel comfortable talking about it?
No, I do.
Good.
It's funny because I feel like we're only starting to really think about it now that the movie is finished.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it was a conscious thing. Like we didn't think like, oh, let's make another movie about the internet or about social media. We just sort of read this story and it grabbed us and we felt like it needed to be made. And now we're kind of, you know, reflecting on it more and seeing, I now that you say that, like it does make sense that it's a continuation of, you can see the line from Catfish to Paranormal to Nerve.
Right.
There was sort of a, you know, an interesting conversation that started after Catfish and it wasn't like it created a phenomenon. But it just put a name to it, you know, something that was already happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then Paranormal Activity was kind of, you know, it was a great lesson in tension for us. It was like putting people on the edge of their seats and like how fun the theatrical experience can be when you're in a big crowded theater and people are screaming their heads off and it's like a roller coaster.
Right.
So Nerve is kind of like a nice combo of those two feelings.
Oh, absolutely. I want to urge people to see this in the movie theater. Don't postpone it till you can watch it on your tablet or something. this really needs to be seen in a movie theater, or like you say, around with a crowd, because it is a it's a lot of fun, and it's so cinematic. The idea is very cinematic. So, and it's like the movie propels you, the story. I mean, it's through it's a, as you said, I think it's like a roller coaster ride of a fun time.
Yeah.
So did the writer, the screenplay, how did you find her, and how did you guys meet up or find this?
We were sent the novel and the script. There was a first draft of the script.
It was a novel?
It was a novel, mm-hmm. YA novel. And we were sent a script by Jessica Scharzer, who writes. She writes an American Horror Story, really great writer. Oh. And so that's what we read, and we kind of went into development with Jessica, and we sat in a lot of rooms together and just tried to come up with dares, and we made a few changes, like moved the story to New York City and kind of changed the nature of the villain, which is a little different from the novel. In the novel, it's like a corporation that's kind of paying to watch kids do crazy things, and we thought, like, you know, you don't really even need to be that sci-fi anymore. Like, we're all doing that. Like, that's what YouTube is. You don't really need a guys in suits, you know, behind something. It's kind of all of us. We're sort of all supporting this culture just by watching.
Right.
Through the act of watching. So we had a lot of fun with Jessica, you know, getting the screenplay ready to shoot, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first portion of the film, anyway, takes place on Staten Island. What was behind that? Nobody makes a film that takes place in Staten Island outside of let's say some of the
Working
Mob. Girl. Yeah. Oh, right. Working Girl is a classic.
Yeah.
Sure. That's true. It's a great film. Right. That's the last one I remember.
I can't think of one since then.
Yeah. But setting it in New York was you mentioned you moved it to New York was
that was a big deal. I think.
What was behind that?
Well, we live here, and we, you know, we hang out, and we're urban explorers, and we're New York history buffs.
Yeah,
and we like, you know, we really like exploring New York City, and feel that it's, you know, it's unfortunate that a lot of films that take place in New York in the story are not really shot here, or they just shoot, you know, they'll shoot the whole movie somewhere else, and then shoot a week of
exteriors,
and it kind of doesn't feel exactly like the city we know. So we really pushed for that, to shoot here and to take advantage of everything it has to offer. This real awesome pizza parlor in Queens and Staten Island, and all the boroughs.
So you shot in Staten Island?
Okay,
so that's great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Keep coming back to Staten Island. So this is authentically Staten Island is what you're saying.
That's right.
It's a bit of a travelogue, isn't it?
Yeah. And her.
Can you ask Ariel this? Just kind of quiet down a little bit.
Yeah, cut it out.
Sorry,
being
that's okay.
Noisy. Raging inside my head right now. What are you thinking about?
All sorts of shit.
Share something. No, but I recall so many movies, even though they take place in New York, and there's lots of you know, scenes shot and the exteriors of New York. Like I remember, for instance, one of the Die Hard movies was all in New York City, but there were three.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is why I wanted you to talk. Yeah, well, you know, which was an exciting sequel, I suppose, but it was there was all those incontinuities. Is that the word? There was mistakes. In other words, like he would drive across, you know, Central Park South, you know, and then end up like in the Village or something. It just that kind of stuff drives
me kills
crazy.
You as a New Yorker watching movies.
Yeah, because it takes you right outside of the story.
Did you notice any in Nerve?
No.
Geographical incontinuities?
No.
Good.
I really didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed
like
that.
There's a moment where they're at Bergdorf's on 58th Street, and their next dare is to get down to St. Mark's where they're going to get tattoos. Right. And we had to and it says like 10 minutes. You know, we're like, all right, he's got a motorcycle, and we know that he runs red lights. That's possible. Yeah, Fifth Avenue, but we knew the Fifth Avenue runs with staggered lights, and you can theoretically go the whole way without stopping.
Yeah, Fifth Avenue is, but a lot of people don't know, but if you just go down the center, it's probably the fastest way. Just go right down Fifth Avenue. I agree with that. So it feels like New Yorkers are making this movie, too.
Good, good.
Yeah.
It better feel that way, because it cost the studio like $2 million more to shoot in New York than Toronto.
But so for those who don't know the story, it is a game. It's a, you know, it's a series of dares that escalate and escalate and escalate. And there are all these different people that are involved in it. Is it a 24-hour game or a one-night game? It seems like it's
So basically, sorry, 24 hours, sun up to sun up.
Mm-hmm.
It pops up. I don't think the dark web audience knows where it's going to be at any given moment. In the movie, it's the second round of Nerve.
Anyway.
So it's like a pop-up game.
Right.
And it's on the dark web, so it sort of evades law enforcement in that way, and that by the time the cops catch up to it, it's already over. And that was our mythology, at least, to explain how this could happen and why we don't have to write the police into the screenplay every 10 pages, you know?
Yeah, no, I noticed that there were these built-in sort of ways of how that came up. You dealt with that actively, in other words, like that.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't the police just show up, you know, and all that?
Yeah, you learn that in horror movie filmmaking, you know, because you have to, your characters have to deal with that.
Logistics.
If there's a demon haunting their house, why don't they leave? Why don't they call the police? If they don't deal with those questions, then you won't trust them as protagonists, you know?
Yeah, and oh, okay, right. You are putting yourself and your trust in the filmmaker,
yeah,
in the experience, and so that's why when you do have the continuity works, it's such a you can let go, and you know that okay, I'm just going to settle in and
trust that you're in good hands.
Exactly. And so David Franco and Emma Roberts are your stars, and those scenes are just terrific, all the dares. They all seem to work. And then there's sort of like kind of a gladiator-esque kind of ending to the film, or denouement or whatever, the climax.
Pièce de résistance.
Okay, you win this round.
Fin de siècle.
Fin de siècle. I guess I'm just trying to say is bravo, guys. This is a very entertaining movie. You guys, this is what you're doing. You're making movies, and have you finished making documentaries, do you think, or?
Never. I think once a documentarian, always a documentarian.
Uh-huh.
It's basically just a love of truth. I think for whatever reasons, we've fallen into a couple movies after Catfish, but we've continued making short documentaries all along, and which are on our website and on YouTube, and we're always looking for a story. But Catfish sort of fell out of the sky. It's hard to go looking for docs like that.
But Nerve is opening on the 29th, is it? What day? I'm going to fuck it up. I know. 27th?
Yeah, it's a Wednesday. So.
But rephrase. Nerve is opening up on the 27th in probably dozens of cities around the country. So I have to ask you one more question about Catfish, because the series, because I do get sucked into it, and they always play like 10 in a row.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I feel... a lot better now that you've actually apologized, because it's the kind of thing that once I'm watching it, which is like every few months, I'll just be channels. I'll actually go to cable for change, and I'll put it on, and I can't turn that fucker off. I can't do it.
What's a television?
I know. How is it possible that there are? I mean, I just got to know. I know you probably get asked this all the time, but seriously, how is it possible that this is going on all over the place? That all these people are lying about their identities and getting away with it.
And people are still falling for it, yeah. I don't know. We're going into season 6 of Catfish, so we'll be approaching like 100 episodes. We just made our
first international episode. I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
We just made our first international episode.
Really? That's true. There's an entire
world
out there.
I don't know if you know this, but outside of the United States.
they lie?
Countries, languages,
yes.
Yeah, cultures.
Which means there are infinite possibilities for people lying about who they are and desperately seeking love.
And finally, because I know we're winding down, is who came up with this idea to make it a series? I'm just kind of curious. When did that occur to you?
My brother Neve was the very first person to say it. We even have that moment on film. Sometime after Sundance with the movie, he said he was starting to get emails, and people were starting to be like, "Oh, hey, Neve, like, oh my God, this is happening to me. Can you help?"
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there was enough of them within the first week of people seeing it that he said, "We could do a TV show."
It's on film.
Is it?
Yeah. It used to be part of the intro. In season one, it was part of the intro.
Okay.
Yeah, because we were filming ourselves all the time.
Right.
And then every network said no, and MTV said yes.
And do you guys ever travel with the guys?
Never have. Always wanted to, but our schedules
you guys
never
are
lined
in New York.
Up. We're always shooting something or something's going on, but I'd love to.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, guys. It's really nice to finally sit down and meet you guys. You're lovely guys.
Yeah.
All right. All All right, so the Blind Boys of Alabama, how sweet... Okay, the film, the documentary, the How Sweet the Sound, The Blind Boys of Alabama, directed by Leslie McCleave, who we're about to have on the show here. That film will be playing at... On Saturday, July 23rd at 5 o'clock at the Stony Brook Film Festival. If you live in Long Island, go to this festival. Not only is Leslie in the film festival, but my friend Joel Fendelman with his film Remittance, and produced by Frank Hall Green. Those two gentlemen were on the show just a couple of weeks ago. That will be playing at the Stony Brook Film Festival on Thursday, July 28th at 9:15 p.m. as well. And not only that, but I also want to plug one other film that's going to be playing there. It's called Love and Taxes. It's directed by this incredibly talented person named Josh Kornbluth. And Josh and I did record a segment last year while we were at the Woodstock Film Festival, and I have yet to put it up. If I can do it in time before the 24th of July, I will, but it seems unlikely given today, as I record this, it's July 20th. But... it was a great conversation, and I saw Josh many years ago, many, many years ago, maybe 15 or more, I don't even know, do a one-man show. It was like off Broadway in New York City, but it was so good. And then here it is, last year I was at the Woodstock Film Festival, and I said, is that the same guy? Is that him? Is the guy? Because my memory is like that. I haven't, you know, I don't forget faces, but I, you know, anyway, it turned out it was. I said, let's sit down and talk. I hadn't even seen his film yet. I still haven't seen it. Anyway, go to the Stony Brook Film Festival. All those films are playing there, many more that are terrific, but I'm going to say go see The Blind Boys of Alabama because it should be pretty terrific, and Leslie will be there. Again, that's on Saturday, July 23rd. Let's listen to my conversation with Leslie McCleave. Right, we met in Nashville in last April. I was on the jury, and very briefly they asked me what category of types of films would I like to watch as a juror ahead of, before the festival. You have to see all the films so you can, you know, you're prepared as a juror. So I selected, of course, Music City. I selected music docs. Yeah. Why wouldn't I? Right. And that was one of them. So I really, you know, it was really great. And it was not, it's interesting, you know, I listened to FUV, you know, all these and different types of, you know, internet radio occasionally. That you'd think they'd play, and they do occasionally play that Blind Boy. Somehow or other, they made it into, kind of crossed over into this genre of roots. Well, it is roots music, I guess.
Roots music, and then, you know, because they sort of became, I think, well-known in their second wave around the time they started to do a lot of these, you know, rock songs and interpret them as gospel songs. Mm-hmm. And so that gave them this whole wide audience, and then they do all these collaborations with different musicians, too.
Oh, I see.
So I think a lot of people, like the FUV audience, would know, you know, Peter Gabriel, and they would know, Solomon Burke, and, you know, that they...
The late Solomon Burke. Well, they're terrific, and I was also fortunate enough to meet a couple of the guys that were in Nashville. We all stayed in the same hotel.
Oh, that's right. All right. So you met Jimmy Carter and Ricky McKinney.
I guess I did. It's a while now.
Yeah.
So,
and we just had Joey Williams at the Brooklyn Film Festival.
Oh.
He was there for Q&A.
Yeah. Well, the moment I went over the Brooklyn Film Festival program of a film that I saw your name, I reached out to whoever the publicist was. I never heard back. God forbid. But anyway, I said, these are the people I want to talk to. And your name was among them.
But I ultimately remembered that
we were on Facebook. So I just ultimately reached out. If we had done it when I reached out to the publicist, we might have been able to even do this before your screening. But, I was surprised because it's been so long. I mean, I guess it's just been a year. That's not unusual for festival run.
Yeah, and this is actually the first time we've been on the East Coast. We've been on the West and a lot in the South. We were out in Honolulu for three screenings, which was great.
That must have been awful.
Yeah, and it was at the Honolulu Museum of Art. It has, you know, museum screening rooms. It was sort of perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guys actually played there the next month, and they hadn't been out to Hawaii in a long time. So that was kind of cool to be able to tell the audience, like, you can go see them at the Blue Note.
There's a Blue Note in Honolulu?
There is now. Yeah, I haven't been to it, but apparently there is.
I didn't realize it was a chain now.
I guess it's a franchise now.
A franchise. Yeah. Now, what's your background? You've made how many films?
I've made, this is my second feature, but my first feature doc.
Uh-huh.
And then I did
So
I did a narrative feature called Road that was an environmental awareness, like social issue narrative. And I've done a bunch of shorts that have, you know, were well known, but I'm sort of out of that loop right now. I'm moving into a web series like everybody, right? So that's what I'm doing summer. Yeah. Shooting a web series.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah. So I've sort of done a lot of varied things. And I did a video installation a few years ago. It was about the post 9/11 cleanup efforts with an artist named Elena Del Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another documentary project, but less traditional doc. It was a, you know, five screen, 22 minute installation. So, but I think like a narrative filmmaker. I think, you know, just storytelling, regardless of whether it's fiction or nonfiction.
Yeah, it seems as though lines are blurred. Anyway, you don't have to be. It's not quite so binary. A film world anymore. You can do whatever you want to do. You can make a film, you can alternate, or you can make something that's perhaps somewhere in the middle.
Right, right.
Which seems to be a trend lately of playing with the lines of fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah, but I do have enormous respect now for people that do documentary as their full-time gig because, you know, it's crazy because you have so much footage and the film can go in all these different directions. And
yeah. And there's no way to predict
what's going to happen. Yeah. It gets written at the end. Yeah.
There are some that you can. I mean, if you're doing a specific story on something happened already, you can kind of script it out more or less. But yeah, if it's something that's unfolding in real time, yeah, how do you know how long it's going to take?
Yeah.
Or in some cases, I'm surprised by how many documentaries I've seen where, you know, they're shooting what they think is a story and then something unpredicted happens, like that just completely explodes the documentary and into a new whole
direction. And then they're like,
direction.
On that, yeah.
And so it's a fortunate thing, but it also, it's like, uh-oh, you know, who knows where this is going to go now. Like somebody gets arrested for something, which I did see recently on this documentary. It's not new, but it was following a band, and I'm going to forget the name of the band, and all of a sudden, it's like a hardcore metal band or something, and the singer got arrested during the course of their making the documentary, the guitarist and camera. And it turns out that at an earlier concert in, like, the Netherlands or something, it was an outdoor festival, and some kid, I don't remember, but he fell off the stage, walked away, but later on had a head injury, it turns out, and died. And so he was brought back to the country, extradited, is that the word?
Uh-huh.
Back into a country that he's not from. I don't know how that works, but he had to on a trial.
They were blaming the band
No, the particular the front man for the band got, not just the front man, because he maybe got, I don't know, there was a tussle of some sort.
Okay.
But he didn't, in any way, they looked at it, in no way. Right. He was completely exonerated, completely. So, but it's an interesting story, and it just reminds me of so many documentaries that I've seen over the years, and I've seen a few. That, which I love. That's why I love documentaries. When did the idea of doing this, the Blind Boys of Alabama, doing that documentary on this particular subject?
I went to film school with a guy who was from North Carolina and who was also a big music fan, but gospel wasn't one of the genres that I knew much about.
Okay.
But he recommended that I see them, and they were at the Bowery Ballroom, but I didn't know who they were really. And they came out and they were very, you know, they were all in these cool suits and all dressed the same and they moved very slowly. And then they were playing with Robert Randolph then, Sacred Pedal Steel.
Sure.
And it was such a fun show and everyone was dancing and jumping up and down and Jimmy goes out into the audience. And I was like, who are they?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, sort of got the sort of capsule story, which is where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
They met at a state-run vocational school. That was segregated, that was educate the deaf and blind together, which was a fairly common thing. It still actually does, that school, though it's no longer segregated, fortunately. And then they were being taught to do, you know, factory work in a blind factory, like making mops and brushes.
Sure.
And they were very ambitious, you know, young men who had learned to sing at school, and they quit school. And so I just thought of that, like, well, they're just quitting school, and they're blind, and they're just like, we're just going to become famous gospel musicians. And it worked out, you know, because when I met them, yeah, they were, you know, touring with, they just opened for Peter Gabriel, and they were doing, you know, the Letterman show that night. And I was like, there must be a movie about this, because it seems like such a long shot success
right.
story.
Yeah.
And there wasn't. So that's sort of the origin. It's just like seeing them being really impressed by the live show, and then yeah, just looking into it.
So when did they form?
They formed in the late 30s at the school.
Really?
Yeah, at the school. It was
30s?
Yeah, the Talladega Institute for the Deaf and Blind. They left school in 44,
uh-huh.
Which is, you know, when they quit. And they were in various ages. Jimmy, who's still in the group, was in the group at the school, but he was the youngest, and his mom, who's in the movie, who's 101, she's passed away now, but okay. She's 101 when we interviewed her, and she, you know, you could see that she was like not going to let him quit school at age 8 to go on the road with these guys.
She died at what age?
I think she died a year, either 102 or 103, a little bit after we filmed her. Yeah,
attending the funeral was her mother.
Right, that was amazing.
Yeah,
that's
insane.
But yeah, so they left, and then you know, it wasn't like an easy path, as you can imagine. Yeah. Up there were, you know, gospel music popularity rose and fell, and
right.
they lost, you know, they just had a lot of challenges, especially, you know, being taken advantage of by a lot of fly-by-night record companies,
sure.
which a lot of people were, you know, some probably sure. not maliciously, just, and some probably maliciously, but being blind, they were, you know, fell victims to that a little bit more, just in terms of the business dealings, but they mm-hmm. just kept doing it. You know, they really feel like that this is a mission and a vocation, because I remember yeah. asking them, like, you're playing at a rock club, like, that seems, shouldn't you be playing in a church? And they're like, well, you know, you want to play at a rock club. That's where they need us.
Yeah.
So they really feel like they're, you know, like doing it as a mission. I'm sure a lot of the audience just thinks this is great Americana music.
Right. Alex, you have Alex Brazil. You have the, do you have some sort of sound effect which can bleep me if I mention a corporation or something like that? You just keep bleeping me. We should do that. We should get that. Some sort. I guess you could do that in post. One can, but because I'm going to say, yeah, having worked at Sony Music, oh, no bleeping there for so many years. I know even there, and they're probably relatively benign. I mean, there's no such really word when it comes to the music industry, but I mean, I can't imagine five men, you know, African-American. It was a five?
Yeah.
There were five?
Five or six.
And
yeah, they always had a
so far,
yeah,
and then
driver.
Yeah. And like, you know, we're talking 50 years ago.
Yeah.
I can't imagine they weren't exploited or taken advantage of by the labels and...
Yeah, there's
years.
A lot, and there were a lot of little labels.
A,
you know, people
it's a
just
deep and rich history of this.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess the same type of people go into the recording side of it. No, and there's just, there's some very good companies. Like Real World was great,
right?
But you know, just
is it
yeah.
gone now?
No, it's still there.
Okay,
they went.
That was Peter Gabriel's.
That was Peter
right.
Gabriel, and that's
yeah.
when that's where they were. They did a couple records
oh, that's
with
why
him.
They opened,
yeah,
right. yeah,
yeah.
They also on that label for a while going back was Joseph Arthur. Do you know him?
Mm-hmm.
What a great!
Bit, yeah, yeah.
I love that guy.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to get him on the podcast.
Oh, cool.
He has a new album too.
Yeah,
he,
I just
but he
saw
was on,
that. Yeah,
he would do the artwork for a lot of the Peter Gabriel
oh,
albums
cool.
early on. I see that might have been how they. I don't know how they met, or I don't know what. Anyway, so how long did it take to make How Sweet the Sound?
It took a long time.
It took a long time.
Yeah, we.
Did
start,
you make other stuff during that?
I did. I made the 9/11 piece,
right.
Which was for the 10th anniversary. So that sort of took me away from it. But we started shooting, we shot pretty much from 2003 to 2013 and then premiered in 2015. And then
nice.
Now we're here in 2016.
After making a film for 10 years, do you not feel there's all the more self-applied pressure to then really like burst out of the gate, like getting it into maybe a top festival? Did you feel that way? Did you try to get it into, did you submit it to, I don't know, like a Sundance or something like that? Or?
I didn't do Sundance because, you know, they've been big supporters of me. I was at the labs and, you know, and my shorts have both been there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt like it wasn't really a Sundance film. You know, it's a very kind of, well, I mean, maybe, you never know. But it was also just that I felt like it was a more traditional style of documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. Most of my narrative work is not very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a deliberate choice, thinking like that's who they are. And so mm-hmm. this isn't really a place for me to get all like, I just want to have this style interpretation. I just want them to mm-hmm. be able to tell their story. And you know, there's like two threads in the movie. One is them on the road for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. and then them telling the history through that. So I thought Nashville was a really great place to premiere because people take music so seriously there, mm-hmm. And because they're a Southern, you know, a Southern origin group.
Sure. No, it makes total sense. I mean, it's the cradle of roots American music is in Nashville, and publishing. And what did the guys think of the film? I mean, here you are following them around for 10 years. They must have thought, geez.
It was really nerve-wracking having them there. But I wanted them, obviously, to see them, you know, see it at the premiere. But, you know, having your subjects in the room.
Yeah.
And they liked it, which was great. And they did the first Q&A. And then Joey had never seen it. I sent them, you know, the link.
They had never seen the film? Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, Joey hadn't seen it. He'd seen it online, bits and pieces, but then when he got to come see it at Brooklyn, you know, it was like a whole different experience with a live crowd, enthusiastic mm-hmm. crowd. So that's nice because, and it's like, I don't think I would spend 10 years again. I think I thought it would be like two or three. It's just interesting things kept happening and I'd be like, well, I should shoot that. And, you know, and then you end up with more and more footage and then sort of looking for an ending.
You're on your third marriage. And did any of the guys, Are they all surviving? Or are they all?
No, the original.
I thought you lost. Yeah, Paul is one of the.
Yeah, of the original members, there's just one that's touring, which is Jimmy Carter, and Clarence Fountain is still fortunately with us, and he contributes vocals sometimes to the more mm-hmm. current releases, which is great. Which he does. He's in Baton Rouge, mm-hmm. and so he'll go into the studio and add tracks, which is terrific. Because I think that was a hard thing to know that. He wants the group to continue on after he has diabetes and mm-hmm. is on dialysis, so he couldn't tour obviously anymore, and yet you know he was the lead singer for so many years, so mm-hmm. wants them to continue on, and yet that the fact that they could continue on was sort of like how I ended the film, and so he sort of come back.
Thank God, finally an ending, because you were waiting for Deus Ex Machina. Speaking of diabetes, there's another. Because I do watch so many, partly for work, partly because I'm on, you know, pre-screening or screening committees or whatever it is, or for the show. And there's another documentary about another band, a musician who where the drummer, I don't remember which one, had failed kidneys,
mm-hmm.
and had to. He was on the list waiting for a new kidney.
Wow.
Because so he was in dialysis, and he decided he was going to tour.
Wow.
And do his own dialysis every day.
Wow, he must be a younger guy.
Yeah, that I was going to say. Yeah, it's a big difference of probably 50 years between them. But it was just miraculous. I wondered what the documentary was a couple years old. I wonder what happened if he was still. I think at one point he went in and it was rejected, and then he had to get on the list.
Well, I think also if you're older, you're not considered a good risk.
Candidate.
Like you're not going to be very high on the list.
Right.
And I think that Clarence, he has a really, you know, moving part where he says you can fire a rocket to the moon and you could, you know, go beyond the moon, but you can't fix someone's kidneys.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you're more tied to home.
Sure.
Three times a week. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand. Again, the name of Leslie McLeave's film is called How Sweet the Sound, The Blind Boys of Alabama. And is it still in the festivals?
Going to festivals? Yeah, it's going to Stony Brook, which is in Long Island, in July, I think July mm-hmm. 23rd.
Oh, yeah. I just had some guys on with a documentary. They told me their film is going to be. I think it was the Remittance guys.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if. They just played at the Brooklyn Film Festival,
yeah,
too,
right?
Yeah,
I just met them, yeah.
Oh, you met Josh, Joel, rather.
I met
Joel
Fendelman
and Frank Hall Green. Joel, he kind of swept some of the awards there.
Yeah,
he did well.
Yeah, he did well. And I wanted to see that film. They were screening right after us.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
Do you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen it.
Well, you can see it at Stony Brook. Maybe I'll come to that.
Yeah,
I have to write them, put the dates on my calendar so I don't forget, because I want to come, and then we can meet up there, too, and it'll be nice to see you. I have to get in touch with those people. Oh, Charlotte. Hey, Charlotte. Hi. Wait one second. Calling in. This is Charlotte, who is my summer intern. She's the daughter of my friend. Okay, this is Charlotte, everybody.
Hey, Charlotte.
Hi, everybody. They can't see you when you wave, but you met Leslie. Let's make a note, or let's find out the dates for the Stony Brook. It's in what month? July?
July, yeah.
And maybe you can even come if you're free. We can make a trip and you can meet, you can see some films. I'll get you a badge. Because I'm trying to, you know,
yeah,
make it worth her while. You know, she's an actress.
It's a nice festival. They have just
you're
one
free to
screening
go.
At a time.
Just kidding around. You can, yeah. Oh, yeah, we can tell them, in a minute, and then we'll bring them in. Brent Barber, who is a very dramatic name. Brent Barber, isn't it?
Yeah.
He runs a festival called the Bicycle Film Festival.
Oh, yeah, I've read about it.
Just tell them the Five Boys of Alabama spend most of the film riding bicycles.
Right. Yeah, and they should definitely have a theme.
Maybe we won't
yeah.
think about it too much, the logical problem there. But and then he maybe there's another festival for you. Well, that's amazing. So you're really did well on getting this into festivals. How many festivals roughly would you say that
We've done maybe 11, 12, something like that. Yeah.
I just had this idea that you were all through since I saw you.
I should probably count, but I don't. Yeah, I should count them up.
Turns out it's like 80.
Yeah.
And that's how fuzzy my math is.
And we haven't screened in Europe yet, and I would like to. So I feel
should.
Like I should do.
I would think they'd.
Where do you think they?
Eat
I don't
that
know.
Up.
Yeah. Like there's a lot
France?
Of there's a lot of documentary festivals.
Is France in Europe still?
It still is. Yeah.
I think that would be a great. I think they would like that film.
I think European audiences would appreciate the music
and South America.
Yeah.
Maybe Brazil.
Yeah.
You know.
Argentina.
Are you still working with
Laura?
Laura, of course.
Yeah. No, she's not working on it anymore. But she worked. She
right.
got
That's
me. You know, to Nashville. Yeah.
Right.
Which was
no,
good.
That was great. And I didn't. You know, she put you on my radar.
Yeah.
And I'm glad she did. And I'm glad I saw it. And I'm glad that you could. Come in today. Thank you. I'm glad.
It's good to give other women chances in the industry because that's part of what I've been doing the last year is hanging out with a lot of female filmmakers.
Oh, and, have you?
Yeah, with a group, Film Fatales.
Oh, sure. And, well, I'm very friendly with that. That I'm a friend of Film Fatales.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just been super helpful to me because it's like
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, you're not
well,
there
in Nashville.
On
also,
yeah.
they right.
Yeah, we had a talk. We had a panel.
There's
and,
a panel.
Yeah. And so it's nice to just have that, kind of thing. So you want to bring people in and work with them.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Sure. No, it's good to, it's good. It's great. And, I try to bring on, I try to make this as equitable a show as possible when it comes to my guests. But
I'm sure that you just see a lot of films that you like, though. And
sure.
So you just call people up and say, come on down.
I do, you know, and I'm working awfully hard to make this more representative of the of what New York looks like and what Brooklyn looks like and what the filmmaking community looks like. So, it's last question, I guess, is have you started to, I don't know if you need a, like if you can even bypass sales agent, that's fine. But have you started to think about
where it should
where
go? Yeah.
The people are going to be able to
that's
eventually.
That's what I'm doing now. Yeah.
So you're working all that, those details
yeah,
out.
Yeah. And there I would love to get it out there. So that's sort of my next phase once you're sort of done with
sure.
it, letting people know about it and see it at festivals. But I think that everyone's always happy that you made a music documentary. You know, it has this longevity,
mm-hmm.
even though it's they're hard to get made because I think people think like someone else will pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, oh, that's a really great topic. Someone else will do that. I should do this like really
mm-hmm.
cutting edge thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then I just appreciate that they're there. I love, mm-hmm. That someone made a Daniel Johnston documentary and someone made a Scott
yeah.
Walker documentary. And,
yeah.
You know, you can
sure.
go back and see them. And Say Amen, Somebody, which is like an amazing film from
what?
The 80s. There's a gospel documentary called Say
oh.
Amen, Somebody.
Oh. Oh, yeah, sure. I saw that. I saw that.
So good. You know, it's like you just, they're
isn't that
touched
with
on.
The Sweet Honey on the Rock? Is that,
no,
that's a separate
this
one.
Was one about the gospel conventions, and it was also
oh,
about
yeah.
Thomas Dorsey.
Oh, yeah. But I definitely, that was big for its time. That did relatively
yeah.
well.
I think it was shot by Ed Lockman. It was gorgeous.
Oh,
and, yeah.
Is that true? I have to get also him on the podcast. Oh, Charlotte. No, I already have a note that I, Ed, believe me. As a matter of fact, I was had on a few of the people from Todd Haynes' last film.
Oh, great.
Because Ed shot that one.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And he was supposed to do the podcast. And then his schedule changed, and unfortunately, because I really wanted him on, Christine Vachon, give me a break. I'm kidding. She's great. And this web series, you're shooting that now. What is the topic?
It is about a female scientist, and
uh-huh.
it's a sort of a hybrid mm-hmm. narrative. It's got some mm-hmm. doc elements because we do a lot of early science photography in it,
mm-hmm.
and that's a little bit like hit or miss, so
mm-hmm.
I'm just sort of incorporating that,
mm-hmm.
like if the shot works or the experiment works.
Okay.
And then weaving that into fictional stories that can be where I don't have to hold a cast. So basically I have one consistent character and then a varying cast. And so we're going to shoot three
okay.
episodes over the summer and
oh,
see where
good.
It goes.
Oh, great. And we're shooting it here?
Yeah.
In this?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Well, if you need them to, if you need a podcast set, feel free to.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio, on Twitter, at FilmWax Radio, on Instagram, at FilmWax Radio. You can go to our website, filmwaxradio.com, and find everything there that will hopefully take care of your FilmWax Radio needs. Be in touch with me. Please do. I'd love to hear from you. Love to get your feedback on the show, suggestions, etc. Listen, hang in there. This election cycle is a doozy. I mean, every time you think it just couldn't get any more bizarre, it does. But let me just tell you, Hillary Clinton should get into the. I'm just saying, it just looks very, very probable. So this is an incredible time because I don't know what the last time that there was a Democratic White House for potentially 16 years. You know. We have to look back and see when the last time that happened. I mean, back then, Democrats weren't even really representing what the Democratic Party is now. And maybe they were better then. I don't know. I'm just at it. Anyway, folks, this has been episode number 362. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. It's part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network. It's presented by the Rooftop Films Festival, which is going on right now. It's at its height right now. It's 20th season. Go to rooftopfilms.com and check out all the remaining films that are screening over the coming weeks. There's plenty to enjoy. I'm going to start going myself. I've been very delinquent in that. And finally, I want to say thank you for listening to the show. Thank you, my listeners. I appreciate it very much. My name is Adam Shardov. Until next time, take care.
Think of younger days when living for my life was everything a man could want to do. I could never see tomorrow. I was never told about the sorrow. And can you mend a broken heart? How can you stop the rain from falling down? Tell me
shining.
What makes the world go round? And how can you mend this broken man? Yeah. How can a loser ever win? Somebody please
help
me
mend
my broken heart and let me live again. La 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 la
la.
I can still feel the breeze that rustles through the trees. And misty memories of days gone by. But we could never see tomorrow. Would you believe that no one ever told us about the sorrow? So stop the rain from falling in my house.